May it please the court, I'm Christopher Wright, representing the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System. We've presented four arguments in our brief, including two arguments that the Copyright Royalty Board is unconstitutional under the Appointments Clause. I'd like to begin by making the argument that the copyright royalty judges are principal officers of the United States, and therefore, as Judge Kavanaugh suggested in his recent concurring opinion, should have been appointed by the president, but were not. They were appointed by the library.
We've never had a scheme quite like this where somebody has a role like the Register of Copyrights. Isn't that right? That's unique, isn't it? And isn't that a major obstacle to your argument? The Register seems to have a fair amount to do with the work of the board.
Let me say, Your Honor, that I think that's what makes this an interesting case. If I could say one sentence before
other
that.
Other than that, it's not an interesting case.
Excuse me? The Supreme Court in Edmund has said that what's important is whether an officer has the power to render a final decision on behalf of the United States. And that's the test I want to make here. And so my main answer to you with respect to the Register's power is that nothing in the Register's power affects the board's...
If the Register is of the view that the board is wrong on the law, well, that in fact does affect the final decision of the board, doesn't it?
No.
We're talking about the instance where there's a novel, substantial issue that the board must go to the Register to get a legal opinion, right? Am I right on that?
So there are two different powers here.
Yeah, I understand, but this is the one I'm interested in, where there's a novel material issue before the board, novel legal issue, and they have to go to the Register to get an opinion. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
And they have to follow what the Register says about the law, right?
So let me address that question.
Okay.
Because I agree, that's the interesting question here. But it doesn't really affect the final decisions of the board, which are rate decisions. And let me give an example first before I do the more general. What happened in this case is that one issue was brought to the Register for his decision. Does the board have authority to issue third-party subpoenas? And as it happened, the Register said yes, but it doesn't.
Sure,
the board doesn't have to.
But can't you imagine situations where the legal judgment, the legal opinion rendered by the Register, would in fact affect the rate?
Right.
And in that case, let's imagine that case.
Your Honor, let me say that this is so hypothetical that I think the rate standard bears a considerable emphasis because the. Let me just say generally that I think it would be very hard for any interpretations of the law are obviously important. The cases are legion, though, that rate making decisions usually require a huge amount of discretion on the part of the rate maker, and that is clearly the case here, and it's the board that makes the decisions. So there's a general standard. This is Section 114F. 1B. The general standard is a willing buyer and willing seller standard. Then the board is told that in determining rates under that standard, it shall consider economic, competitive, and programming information. And then there are two subsections under that of the sorts of things that the board is to consider, including whether the service may substitute for or may promote the sales of phono records. Those factors point in different directions. Whether they may otherwise interfere with or enhance sound recording copyrights owners' other streams of revenues, those go in other directions. And then the second group of factors involves the relative roles of the copyright owner and the transmitting entity with respect to a host of factors, including relative creative contribution, technological contribution, capital investment, cost, and risk. Now, first, let me say that I don't understand that the Register has ever even been asked to weigh in on these factors. But what I'm suggesting is that even the best interpretation of any one of those factors is never going to lead to a particular rate. And the webcasters and SoundExchange ultimately care about the rates. and everything else is important only to the extent that it makes a rate higher or lower.
So let me ask, over time, do the judges just like, I don't know, take 10 factors, throw them up in the air, divide them by 10, and that's the answer? Or over time, do they decide that promoting the sales of phone records doesn't really apply that much in this kind of industry, or competitive factors are more important? Do they have any, even among themselves, even making a decision? Is it just a flip of the coin? Is it just total arbitrariness? Or do they apply some kind of standard?
Your Honor, they pay the most attention to agreements that have been negotiated in the market that may or may not be comparable, and their arguments about whether or not they're comparable. Mm-hmm. And then the parties make a host of arguments on these issues. I think it is fair to say that there is not a whole lot of clarity about how any of these factors apply. In fairness to the board, it was created in 2004, so it takes time for terms like this to
get. So would it not be possible for the register to, since it has authority to construe the terms, to confine, at least to some extent, the discretion of the judges by saying, for example, the principal factor you must consider is comparative agreements, and that's the presumption, that's our legal interpretation, that's the presumption, and you can't vary from that without, and then have some standard for when they can vary, and then give some list of priorities for these factors as a legal matter.
You know, that is possible, Your Honor. It hasn't happened. I think that, in fairness, the way the parties have acted represents the congressional intent in drafting this statute, which is that the board will make the rate decisions. The board will act as a rate body. And frankly, the register's role is more the sort of third-party subpoena issues and other kind of process issues.
It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that they only have authority over process.
They could opine on any of those.
So they could. I appreciate there's some level of discretion that is unalterable here, but they could constrain the discretion through a series of legal decisions.
They could constrain the discretion. Let me say that wouldn't mean that the decisions of the board were not ultimately final decisions of the United States. And actually, if I could pick up on one point Judge Griffith made early on, which is the lack of historical precedent for this board. The Supreme Court noted that factor in the Free Enterprise Fund case recently and said that it weighed heavily, extremely heavily, against the constitutionality of the public company investment accounting board that was struck down in that case. And if I can move for a moment to the purposes of the appointments clause and separation of powers, of which it is an aspect.
Can I just go back very briefly on the register? How often, in fact, has the register exercised this power?
It's pretty unusual. Again, I think the example I gave you was the only example in this case. We'd be happy to answer that. I can also note that the board has a fairly good website, and you can click their proceedings and find out all the orders.
They also did intervene, I take it, with a legal position in our previous case with the royalty judges.
Right.
Sirius XM, and we all treated that as ending that issue. Everybody treated that as ending that issue.
Well, Your Honor, again, I find it, though, hard to imagine that in this case, where, of course, the board came out with a whole range of rate schedules covering webcasting of all sorts, that the register would come in and argue that
no question that the run-of-the-mill case, but don't you concede that there are sometimes legal judgments do determine what the rate's going to be? I mean, we do that all the time in our regulatory
cases. Of course.
And in that instance, when the register opines on what the law is, it is going to have an effect on the rate in that case, right?
Under this standard, it is hard to believe that it would ever direct any particular rate to be selected, however.
Well, no, they don't have to say at the end of the day the rate is X, but they've established the law, and the law will determine what the rate will be.
The register may well be a principal officer as well, who is appointed in violation of the appointments clause. But nothing the register does changes the fact that the board's decisions are final decisions of the United States that are appealable to this court. And that's the test under Edmund.
And under Edmund, that would be solved, would it not, if the judges did not have their tenure?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If the judges could be removed at will, I assume by the librarian, then the Edmund problem would be solved, right?
That would certainly change this case. I believe what the Supreme Court has said about boards is that what is significant, that's what preceded its statement that they render a final decision. Now, let me say, as a policy basis, this would be very different if the librarian could remove the copyright royalty judges.
I'm not talking about a policy basis. I'm talking about, assuming arguendo, the merits of your constitutional position, what a remedy would be.
Well, I don't have to defend an argument that they're principal officers, even though they can be removed, if they could be removed at will, because they can't be removed at will, and I agree, I'd probably lose that case. But they can only be removed for cause, and the specific statute here is fairly detailed, and it covers matters such as they can be fired for violating the financial conflict of interest rules and for neglect of duty, and if there's reason to call their mental competence into effect. What they can't be fired for is making a bad rate decision.
Well, the same exactly was true in Edmonds. They could not be fired or removed for the outcome in a particular case.
So, but in Edmond, yep, every single opinion of that Coast Guard body could be reviewed by the intermediate or by the overall.
It's in the executive branch, right?
Excuse me, but I'm sorry. No, it's my. But not for the facts. So it could not be reviewed with respect to the facts. The Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, I'm reading from Edmond, will not reevaluate the facts. Just like here, it could be reevaluated for the law, but it could not be reevaluated for the facts. And it could not change the result in a run-of-the-mill case in which there's no law question, guilty or not guilty, guilty of this or not guilty of this, the Court of Appeals could not reevaluate that. Why isn't that the same as this case where the register can intervene with respect to the law but not reevaluate the facts? And here the fact is, what is the copyright rate?
I'm sorry, here the fact?
And here the fact is, what is the specific rate we're deciding on?
Your Honor, I guess I think that seeing as what's most important is the setting of the rates here, and it is always an interaction of the law and the rates, the law and the facts that ends up affecting the rates, that ultimately supports the conclusion here that the judges are principal officers. It would be strange that what I think turns out to be the lesser power in a rate-making case to decide issues like third-party subpoenas or perhaps weigh in on what one of the 11 factors means is more important than the actual selection of the rates.
I ask you again, how is that? When I look closely at Edmund, I'm asking you what the difference really is. So in Edmund, although the court says that the judge advocate general may remove a court of criminal appeals judge from his judicial assignment without cause, two sentences later the court says he may not attempt to influence by threat of removal or otherwise the outcome of an individual proceeding and has no power to reverse the decisions of the court. In fact, then cites the Code of Military Justice, which is the classic declaration that there shall be no command influence, which says, and this is 10 U.S.C. 837, that no authority may censure, reprimand, or admonish the court or any member with respect to the findings or sentence adjudged by the court. No person subject to this chapter may attempt to coerce any member of the court with respect to the findings in any case. And certainly the most important thing that the court does is decide whether somebody is innocent or not, guilty or not. And that most important thing, no other member of the executive branch could remove.
That was the part addressing the judge advocate general's powers.
Yes.
It's right after that that we get to the power of the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces.
And that says the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces will not reevaluate the facts.
But it also says that every decision of the judge advocate general is reviewable by that court, either by essentially a sort of certiorari review, and there's some mandatory appellate type review. And that paragraph concludes with the sentence that what is significant is that the judges of the Court of Criminal Appeals have no power to render a final decision on behalf of the United States unless permitted to do so by other executive officers.
Yes, but
this case would be analogous.
Let me just,
if the register or the librarian could say, "No, we're reversing your order. They
but
can't
the,
be taken
the
to court."
The question is, what is the meaning of the sentence you say? It says, "What is significant is that the judges have no power to render a final decision." It precedes immediately the sentence that I just mentioned, which is that the Court of Appeals will not reevaluate the facts. So yes, the Court of Appeals can reverse if the judges make a mistake with respect to the law, but assuming that they apply the law correctly, the decision about whether the member of the armed forces is innocent or guilty cannot be reversed. And the Court of Appeals judges, if they make a mistake, they can't be reversed either. The president may not remove its judges except for neglect of duty, misconduct, or mental or physical disability. That is, even the second level, there's almost a peekaboo problem here. There's a second level of for-cause protection for the judges of the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces.
Okay. So, Your Honor, I think that the court has rehearsed all the facts. It's included some factors that point towards the conclusion that these judges might be principal officers and some that point against it. Mm-hmm. And then it concludes that what really matters is that there's somebody else before you get to an Article III court that can reverse the decision.
Right. That's
what's missing here.
No, but as to the law, so the question that was asked by Judge Griffith is, you can be reversed as to the law, you can't be reversed as to you.
Well, you
the judges can't be reversed.
That's an important factor.
Well, you can be reversed as to the law. That is, that according to the statute, the copyright royalty tribunal has to apply the legal determination of the register, and even afterwards, the register shall issue an opinion correcting such legal error.
But that doesn't reverse the order of the board or make it unappealable. The register's order ultimately is to intervene in this court and present its arguments to this court, which can accept it.
In Edmund, who was the last decision maker in the executive branch to consider any of the cases? Who was the last decision maker in the executive branch in Edmund? Who had final authority?
It could have been the Court of Military Review, I believe is its name. Which has a sort of a certiorari.
The reference in Edmonds to the Court of Criminal Appeals. What?
That's the Coast Guard Court at issue here.
So the Court of Appeals for the Armed for the Armed Forces. Right. Right.
No, I'm sorry. If I've got the.
I'm looking at page 662.
Right at the beginning of the case, the court first talks about the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals.
Right, and they call it the Court of Criminal Appeals, right?
Yeah, and later call it. But so.
And they were the final decision makers within the executive branch in Edmund, right?
No, well, they're described by the Supreme Court as an intermediate court within the military justice system.
Now, didn't they have the right to look into the factual determinations? Review them de novo?
Yes, but their decisions are subject to review by the United States Court of Appeal for the Armed Forces, okay. Formerly known as the United States Court of Military Appeals. So Well, so they're both called courts of appeals, but it's a court for the armed forces that has the final say, and it was the fact that the court for the armed forces could review a decision of the intermediate court, the Coast Guard court at issue there, that made the Coast Guard court, the members of that court, inferior officers rather than principal officers.
But it couldn't interfere with a decision with respect to the facts.
That's right, and so the court says that there has to be review to some extent. It doesn't have to. It certainly doesn't have to be de novo review. But again, what's different here is that there is no decision maker that reverses a rate decision after the copyright royalty judges make it. They are reviewable in this court.
Is it part of your argument basically that between the law and an outcome, when we're talking about the copyright royalty judges, there's a very broad range of discretionary choice, whereas, perhaps, arguably, in the application of a legal concept to an alleged crime, if the, apart from the facts, there isn't such a range of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor. I think in the real world there's a world of difference there.
Can you help me with one curiosity of the statute? I'm not sure I'm understanding. In 802F1A2, it has a clause at the very end. I think it's like...
And I'm sorry, are you looking at the opening brief?
No, I'm just looking at the statute.
Just looking at the statute, sir.
I love looking at your briefs, but the statutes is where I start.
Well, the brief has the statute appended. I was hoping to find it to follow along with you.
Okay. Yeah, that would be helpful, I'm sure.
And I'm sorry, it's 801.
A11.
802.
A11, thank
yeah.
you.
Okay, good. It's at the end of A. That is... F1A double I, it says, the authority under this clause shall not be construed to authorize the Register of Copyrights to provide an interpretation of questions of procedure, comma, the ultimate adjustments and determinations of copyright royalty rates and terms. See where I am? It's the very last sentence before B.
Right, Your Honor, and I'm sorry, I should have highlighted that before. Yeah. The ultimate determination of royalty rates and terms cannot be adjusted.
Right. I think that,
only this court can do that. Only this court can conclusively say that the judges got it wrong.
So, but why does it say under this clause? That is, why isn't there a similar thing under B? Or D?
Well, this is, of course...
curious that it would only be... everybody has assumed, I think both sides assume, that this is the rule, that ultimate adjustments and determination of rates and terms are made by the judges. Why is it only in that one provision? Yeah. And is there a negative implication from that?
I don't think that's right. This is the general clause, sort of, in making decisions. If you start with F1, that talks about the full independence of the board in making rate determinations, and I think if you read that, what that means is they have full independence. No one can reverse their rate decisions, and then there are these special provisions we've been talking about that follow that, novel questions.
But fair enough. That's a possibility. I was reading A as being the non-novel questions, that is, the ones that are governed by precedent.
Well, A is entitled in general, at least in the version I have in front of me. So
no, it's I got the title, same title. But it seems to be about cases where there are already precedents as compared to B. But maybe the answer is the one you say, which is this is a general statement that applies all the way through.
Right. We cited a number of cases from this court and the Supreme Court in our brief. I don't want to say that rate making is sausage making, but everyone knows that rate making has similar aspects to it. There are always a lot of factors, or they always point different ways, and the power to make the rates is what's important. And for good measure, as Judge Kavanaugh stated in his concurring opinion, the rates here affect billions of dollars and the fates of entire industries. And one word on sort of the reasons underlying this. We shouldn't go down the road. It would be a mistake to go down the road of okaying strange constructions like this. If Congress may create a body that sure looks like it renders final decisions by principal officers, but then add a couple of bells and whistles that allows someone other than the president to appoint those officers, that will enhance Congress's power relative to the president's, and separation of powers and the appointments clause is all about preventing that. And the other purpose is to make it clear who is responsible ultimately for decisions. And in the Free Enterprise Fund case, the Chief Justice emphasized that. And I think it's directly relevant here. There's ultimately four Matryoshka dolls. The president appoints a librarian who appoints a register.
But he's free to remove the librarian.
He's free to remove the librarian, but is a decision of the copyright, is a rate decision of the copyright royalty judges, may the president fairly be blamed if, as in this case, it might put certain college webcasters out of business? Well, the president didn't appoint the judges, can't fire the judges. The librarian appointed the judges, can only remove them for cause, for certain specified violations. And the register actually kind of makes it worse here.
That takes me back to the remedy that I asked you about earlier, and whether, assuming you're right on the substance, eliminating the tenure of the judges would do the job.
I don't. You mean allowing them to be fired? Then I think that the president could fairly be blamed for a bad decision on the merits, because, you know, he could tell the librarian that I'm going to fire you if you don't fire the judges. But that's not the case here.
So what is the remedy if you're right here? If you're right, we just throw this all out and we leave the parties to figure out individual basis negotiating the contract, the copyright for every single recording.
Well, Your Honor, there is a de facto officer doctrine, so that prior decisions of, I'm sure parties will argue.
No, but for the future, I got that part. But the question is, and I take it that you want, with respect to this case, it to be vacated. But in the Peekaboo case, the court made an adjustment in the statute. Do you want us to make an adjustment if you're right, or do you want us to just throw it open for the war of all against all?
Closer to the latter. I forget whether it was Buckley v. Vallejo or one of the other cases. The court issued a stay for 30 days, basically to allow Congress to adjust the statute. That's the only remedy here. Congress has to decide, should the president appoint the judges, should the judges be subject to firing at will, or should there be real review, full review inside the Library of Congress? There are many choices.
I understand, assuming Congress is not able to act within 30 days, notwithstanding its general ability to act that quickly, what would happen after 30 days to the industry, all this large industry that you're talking about with all the billions of dollars? What would actually practically happen?
Well, fortunately, the board usually sets rates for 5 years. So under the de facto officer doctrine, presumably the other rates would stay in effect at least until the term expired. There might be arguments about that, but I don't think the world would fall apart.
Anything coming up for renewal?
Every year they do at least one major decision.
So leave aside the possibility that there's various kind of delays built into the system. But what does happen without the board at all, without the judges at all?
I suppose the first issue would be whether or not the parties could agree to rates in the interim. My client, the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System, presumably wouldn't have to pay the $500 administrative fee.
Presumably your client isn't part of those $1 billion worth of in the industry.
Let me
assure you people sitting in the audience nervously waiting for the answer. What does happen under these circumstances?
Well, honestly, Your Honor, in the real world, many of the people in this audience would descend on Capitol Hill and say, this is a crisis, you have to fix this. And while I can't, no one can guarantee that Congress would fix it, we're a democracy, that's what ought to happen.
And why isn't just eliminating the for-cause requirement sufficient?
So could the court say...
Well, that's what it said, and that's what the Supreme Court said in the Peekaboo, right?
Or I don't think the court could. I mean, our main argument is that the judges ought to be appointed by the president. I don't think the court
assume
could
you lose
say,
that.
Say that.
I'm sorry?
I don't think the court could order the president.
We're talking about the question, just focusing on this question of whether they are inferior to the register for the moment. If you were to win on that point, would it not be an appropriate remedy to just allow the register to remove them?
That specifically wouldn't work because the register isn't appointed by the president, and I think at least the librarian would have to remove that. But my honest reaction is that's more than the court should do. I think the court should rule that they are principal officers.
Why wasn't that the right thing to do for the Supreme Court in the Peekaboo case? Why wasn't that the right thing for the Supreme Court to do in that case? I'll let you think about it until you come back in rebuttal. All right, I think we'll hear from Ms. Corcoran now. Is that right?
May it please the court, my name is Kelsey Brown Corcoran. I'm here on behalf of the Copyright Royalty Board and the Librarian of Congress. The Supreme Court has addressed inferior officer status in four cases. Morrison, Freytag, Edmund, and Free Enterprise. And each of these cases...
A lot of people would like to forget Morrison.
In each of these cases presents a different constellation of facts, but what they all have in common is that in every case, the challenged officer exercised significant authority on behalf of the United States. That's what distinguishes an officer from an employee. And in every one of these cases, the Supreme Court found that the officer was inferior because he or she was at some level supervised by a principal officer.
So where's the supervision here?
Okay. So here we have supervision in a number of respects. We've talked a lot about the reviewability of the decisions. It's okay, I'll get to that in a minute and talk about a couple of different meaningful restrictions. In particular, the tenure restriction. The judges are limited to 6-year terms. And then also the for-cause removal provision, which was significant in Morrison. But let's talk about tenure first.
Well, let me just get to what seems to me to be the bottom line that is the strongest argument of opposing counsel, which is that even if you can control their legal decisions, even if you can control their ethical decisions, which is seems to me what the removal authority has to do with, conflicts of interest, et cetera, and even if you can take away their desks, which is apparently one of the sections you're relying on, it is still the case that this statute, a little bit like the Postal Rate Commission statute we saw before, has a large number of factors which have to be weighed by the judges. And when they do, in doing that, they necessarily make policy with respect to copyright. And that part doesn't seem reviewable unless you can help me how it would be.
We agree that the judge's factual determinations are not reviewable
more
by the register.
Exercise discretion among... in terms of the weighting of the factors.
Right. And the statutory language distinguishes between the legal determinations, which are under the authority of the register, and then the factual rate determinations, which fall under the authority of the judges. As you pointed out earlier, Judge Garland, that Edmund is a case where also there were, to a certain extent, decisions being made that were unreviewable, and that's actually true in all four of the cases that have been decided by the Supreme Court. So in Freytag, the particular decision that was being challenged had been reviewed by the tax court, but the Supreme Court pointed out that the special trial judges were unreviewable in other contexts.
Actually, you know, unfortunately, that's not actually – it is what the court said. They said it was final. They didn't say it was unreviewable, and the statute actually makes it reviewable. By the other judges of the tax court. I don't know.
But they don't seem to, that
really wasn't the issue in that case, right? That issue, that case was,
but I think,
were there officers or not.
Yeah. And so that's what's significant. The Supreme Court pointed to the supposed non-reviewability of the declaratory judgment decisions in certain categories of tax cases and relied on that.
I understand that. But I mean, Mr. Wright's answer to my question was, that's sort of an on-off switch, guilty, not guilty, in one particular case. Here, it's nothing like that. There's a huge round of policy to be made with respect to how these various factors are balanced. And that's a lot of discretion to give, more discretion than applying the law to the facts. I mean, we don't think of a jury as making criminal law policy, right? They apply the law, they apply to the law as given to them by the judge, the facts. Here, I think we could reasonably and liberally read what the authority of the registrar is to set the law, but still, it's not, you know, just apply this law. You have all these factors.
Well, the factors are actually restricting the judges. We have a list of policies they're supposed to consider, so in that sense, those provisions serve as a limitation.
It doesn't tell you how to weigh them. How do you weigh relative creative contributions against promotion of the sale of phono records against comparable types of digital transmission services against economic, competitive, and
Yeah, and I think all of those decisions are within the discretion of the judges, and that's permissible under the Supreme Court's precedent on inferior or officer status. And I'll point out that in each of the cases that the Supreme Court has decided, they have found the officer to be clearly within the category of inferior. You have that language along those lines in all of the cases. And so we shouldn't think of those cases as setting the outer bounds for inferior status. There's a lot of room in between. Even that said, I think that the judges fall squarely within the cases we have. I mean, we talked about the discretion in Freytag and Edmund, but also in Morrison, the Supreme Court talked about the fact that the Attorney General essentially had no authority over the independent counsel with respect to her exercise of the prosecutorial.
Edmund stresses that that involved a very narrow and even time-limited mission.
Yeah, and so when you get to Edmund.
Not the case here. This is billions of dollars for going on and on and on.
Yeah, so let's...
Although I guess in that case, Mr. Olson would care more about his liberty than he would care about the billions of dollars.
So I actually do think that the six-year tenure restriction that I started to talk about earlier does make this case more analogous to Morrison than you might expect. So we have four areas of rate determinations that are made by the judges, and each of those determinations is made once every 5 years. So the practical impact of that is the judges have six-year terms. They are going to get a shot at one of each type of determination before they're up for reappointment, and the librarian has full discretion on whether to reappoint them. And so in that sense, we are talking about a limited number of decisions that are going to be made by the judges.
There are decisions about balancing the factors are then precedent for the next set of judges. Right.
Yes, I think that's the judges' decisions are precedential in that sense. But I don't think there's any... each of these cases ends up being so fact-determined based on kind of the facts that are before the judges in that case. It's hard for me. I mean, we don't have a lot of case law, so it's hard to see how that plays out. But it strikes me that the kind of determinations that are being made here are not ones where there's going to be a lot of precedential value coming out of the judges' determinations.
By the same token, suggests the breadth of their discretion.
Yes, I think that's right. And again, the judges have discretion with regard to the rate determinations. The question is, are they supervised at some level by the librarian? And we've talked about the legal corrections.
Is that right? At some level?
At some level.
Any supervision by the librarian answers the question?
Edmund uses the phrase at some level, and then if you move to Morrison, the Supreme Court said, you know, again, recognizing that the independent counsel was exercising the, all the prosecutorial and enforcement powers of the Department of Justice with no supervisory person overseeing any of that, and then went on to say, but because the independent counsel is removable for cause by the Attorney General, that indicates that she is to some degree inferior in rank and authority. So we don't need to have a whole set of authorities that limit the judges. You just need to be able to identify a few that suggest that the judges are inferior to the librarian. Well,
Olson, how this would be enforced, I don't know, but in Olson, the court noted that this independent counsel is required to follow the policies of the Justice Department. And there's some discussion in either your brief or intervener's brief, I think, about policy being set by the registrar. But I'm unclear on what that means in this area. What does that I mean, if it were the case that registrar set the law and the policy and all that the judges did was apply that to rate making, notwithstanding the fact that there's, you know, some breadth to that, that would be different. But is there a way in which whatever policy means in this area can be set by the registrar?
So maybe it would be helpful in answering that to talk about the kinds of legal corrections that the registrar has issued so far. So as I said before, there have been four determinations in the last 6 years, four rate determinations. Judges have asked for six legal opinions. They have addressed such issues as whether a particular service fell within under a statutory license, such as Section 115. A number of them have had to do with the extent to which the judges have authority to issue regulations in particular areas. And so those six opinions are binding and have been binding on the judges. And then, again, four determinations, two of them have been corrected by the register.
Did any of those affect the outcome of the rate?
So in the satellite radio case, which Judge Griffith is familiar with, the judges had declined to set a rate for ephemeral recordings under Section 112 because they hadn't received, they believed they hadn't received sufficient evidence to set the rate. That was corrected by the register and said that you don't have authority not to set a rate in that area. What happened was that case went on appeal to this court, and so the Justice Department ended up asking for a remand so that the judges could implement that correction. And so that's, you know, pretty substantive. They had to reopen the case and do additional fact-finding.
The authority of the register can be, use your term, pretty substantive, and still leave huge discretion in the judges.
That's right. I think the legal bounds of what the registrar is doing are significant, but they are exercising discretion with regard to factual determinations. But again, if the librarian...
Just to make clear, you use the word factual to mean everything other than clear questions of law.
That's my interpretation. Certainly, if this court thought as a matter of constitutional avoidance...
That's fine, as long as we understand that you don't mean factual in the traditional sense of the word factual.
Could you pursue the as a matter of constitutional avoidance sentence that you began?
Well, so Judge Garland started to point out earlier that there maybe was some ambiguity, and I think it was 802F1. The position that the government has taken is that the register's legal corrections are binding. They do correct the determination that is at issue in that case. But we have taken the position that the judges have discretion with regard to rate determinations. If you read the language differently and you think that's important as a matter of constitutional avoidance, that's certainly preferable to striking down the entire statutory scheme.
Well, there's two different, you can do constitutional avoidance when it's possible and you can't do it when it's not. That, I take it, you don't think that that phrase I was reading applied only to non-novel situation.
No, I haven't had a conversation with my colleagues about that particular phrase, but our position. But
your general position is that ultimate adjustment and determination of copyright royalty rates and terms is up to the judges,
yes,
bounded only by the legal decisions.
But I want.
Let's,
Sorry, I'll just yes? go back to my point earlier. You're talking about four determinations that will be made before the judge's tenure is complete. And at that point, there's within the discretion of the librarian to say, I don't like the way that you have been applying the factors laid out in 112 and 114 or in 801, and therefore I'm not reappointing.
The librarian, by regulation, construe the factors and establish priority among the factors or how the factors should apply. This is one phrase in the statute that's unclear, which is what kind of regulations the register can issue. The librarian seems to be given the power to issue regulations with respect to governance of the library, which doesn't, I think you would agree, doesn't really seem to apply here. Mm-hmm. But the register doesn't really say what authority, it certainly talks about its regulations. It doesn't say what kind of regulations it can issue. Can it issue regulations that would constrain the judges?
So you have the broad language about their kind of their authority to promulgate regulations. I think you have to balance that against the language in 802 that discusses the judge's independence in their rate determinations. So we haven't come across haven't been presented with a situation where we've had to draw that line clearly, but I think the court looking at how those provisions should be interpreted would consider both of them.
Well, independence can mean just like a judge, we are independent, but we don't decide the policy. Congress tells us what the policy is, what the law is, and we apply it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And so they could be independent with respect to applying policy, but my question is there a way for the register to tell them what the policy is?
Yeah. Again, if this court,
What would be the way? Assuming they have the authority, how would they do it? Could they, announce that factor one is more important than factor two? Is that a legal issue that they're allowed to opine on?
I think there's an ambiguity in the statute with respect to that question that hasn't been grappled with because the register hasn't done anything similar to what you're suggesting. We would leave it to this court to determine
maybe I should ask another way. Is it even doable? That is, assume they had the authority. I think the bottom, my underlying problem is not understanding what a copyright policy might be under these circumstances. Under what circumstances would you, other than, corruption, which you certainly have the ability to remove somebody, for what policy reason would you want to be able to remove somebody?
Do you think someone is, or I guess the idea would be that the judges had not given sufficient weight to one of the four factors in 801? And that you would perhaps have a regulation saying that they have to give each factor equal weight, or is that?
That's what I'm asking, but I don't know whether that has any relevance to the real world of copyright.
At this point we're talking about an entity that's only been around for 6 years, so I think there are a lot of open questions about how the statute can be interpreted, and this court is free to do what it thinks it needs to do in order to uphold the constitutionality of the statutory scheme. And on that note, I wanted to follow up on both Judge Garland and Judge Williams' point about severability. We think that the for-cause removal provision falls squarely under Morrison, as opposed to Free Enterprise, where you had the double layer of tenure protection. But certainly, if this court thought that the interaction between the for-cause removal provision and the non-reviewability of the judge's factual determinations was sufficient to render the statutory scheme unconstitutional, which is essentially what you had in Free Enterprise, where you had a number of different factors that worked together to create a constitutional problem, you certainly could sever the for-cause removal provision. I don't see any reason that Free Enterprise wouldn't be exactly on point in that respect.
And is that the least bad thing we could do to copyright law? This matters, right? Use some remedy, we would want to do the least disruptive remedy. Would that be the least disruptive one?
I think that would be the least disruptive. And then we, maybe a final point, or I'm happy to answer any other questions on the judge's inferior officer status, but to keep in mind the scope of what the judges are doing, the appellant in its reply brief analogizes to the FCC commissioners, the NLRB, and a number of other large entities. I just want to keep in mind that the FCC commissioners oversee a staff of 2,000 people with a budget of over $300 million, and each of those other entities also has well over 1,000 staff and nine-figure budgets. In comparison, the judge's budget last year was $1.2 million, and they are statutory.
That can't be the test, really.
No, my point is just that the scope of what they're doing is much more limited than what some of these other agencies are doing. They are statutorily limited to three employees. So you have an office of six people, three judges, three employees. And part of the reason the office is so small is because the statutory scheme was designed by Congress to encourage parties to only go to the judges as a last resort. So throughout the scheme, you see that parties are encouraged to privately negotiate. And in fact, Sound Exchange points out in their brief that 95% of the royalties that they receive are pursuant to private contractual arrangements.
Did the executive branch weigh in on this proposal at all when it was before Congress?
I don't know the answer to that. Sorry. Again, this is just a point about kind of the scope of what the judges are doing. And so I would go back, you know, suggesting how this case comes out. You can identify a number of respects in which the judges are inferior to the librarian. You have the for-cause removal provision, you have appointment with limited tenure, and then you have the fact that the legal decisions are being reviewed. And as I explained before, that is not an insignificant review. The registrar has exercised that authority in half of the cases that have been decided so far. I would like to speak for a moment about the library's status as an executive department, if the court is interested in that issue.
Just ask whether.
Oh.
I would rest on your briefs on that one,
okay.
If I were you.
Okay.
I think we're now going to hear from the intervener, correct?
Thank you, Your Honors. Michael DeSanctis, representing Sound Exchange, which was the prevailing party below, and may it please the court. I was originally going to get up here and be the one to address the merits issues that are at the very end.
But you noticed that the remedy might make more difference to you than it apparently makes to Mr. Wright's client.
That's where I'm going. There's been some more important issues raised during the arguments today that I wanted to address. First of all, Mr. Wright made obviously a big issue about the discretion that appears to be permitted to be exercised by the copyright royalty judges in 114F2B, Romanets 1 and 2. These factors about whether a service substitutes or promotes sales and the relative values and the relative roles, et cetera. The way the copyright judges dealt with those factors in this case, which we refer to colloquially as Web3, and in the prior case, which was referred to as Webcasting 2, is a little different than Mr. Wright suggests. What the judges have done is they have focused on the willing buyer, willing seller standard. And they've said, in order to determine what a willing buyer and willing seller, what rate a willing buyer and willing seller would arrive at the marketplace, we will look to freely negotiated agreements that come from the marketplace, and we'll look to those rates and make adjustments as necessary. They then said that these factors are actually incorporated into the market rates because those are the factors that parties think about in the marketplace. That was essentially their analysis in Webcasting 2, and it was their analysis in Webcasting 3. Presumably, the Register of Copyrights could have said, no, that's the absolute wrong way to go about it. That's not what the statute requires. It requires something different. The Register didn't say that. So the question I think that Mr. Wright is focusing on is actually not what the judges have done in this case and has actually never come up. But I want to address Your Honor's questions primarily.
Stick with that for a minute. So when you say that, you mean there aren't 20 factors which they throw up in the air and decide which one is most important, but there's really only one. They've decided as a matter of law/policy which the registrar has not tried to correct, that there's really only one factor, that's comparison to freely negotiated rates, and all these other things are just minor elements of either already included in or just minor elements of that?
It's not that it's minor. It's that they're included. It was actually...
They don't have to look to any of these other things.
Exactly. They say by looking at deals that are freely negotiated in the marketplace, we are necessarily considering these factors because those are exactly the factors that parties consider in the marketplace, sellers and purchasers.
And what is their what is the scope of their discretion then under their own view? What discretion do they apply then?
I certainly don't want to speak for their own view of
what it's not subjective test. This is what do you see from the opinions? Mm-hmm. I think up until this exact moment in the oral argument, we've sort of gone along with the idea that there's a wide bound of discretion here for the judges. Mm-hmm. You introduced the possibility that the legal/policy issue has already been decided. It's only one. It's cosmic. The register could have, and maybe will in the future if it wants to, adjust that one. But as long as that's the only policy, then their only job, and this probably overstates your view, but tell me what's correct. Their only job is to figure out what the marketplace, comparative marketplace agreements are, and to apply those to this case. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's exactly what they've done in this case and in the Webcaster 2 case. The if you look at the judge's analysis and you know they're long opinions, but what they're doing is analyzing typically expert testimony about what rates prevail in freely negotiated marketplace deals. Then the experts have to do some adjustments.
Whether the deals are parallel to the transactions that are to be covered by the rule, and at least my general sense of that is that that can be an extremely difficult, contentious problem.
The question of what are the right types of agreements to look to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another way to analyze that is whatever agreement you look to, you then have to make adjustments, and what are those appropriate adjustments? And that is precisely the judge's analysis. They've looked to the marketplace rates. They've, first of all, identified what are the most analogous marketplace rates, and then they have made whatever adjustments they deem necessary. And they have done it in a very straightforward fashion. I'm not saying that there's only one way to come out on that, but they have not done it by applying these very amorphous or more amorphous sounding factors. Those, they have said, are embodied in marketplace agreements, and so it has been a much more numerical, expert-driven analysis on what rates prevail in the marketplace rather than these. You could search the decision in Webcaster 3 and in Webcaster 2 for extended discussion of, or really any discussion other than what I've already described, of these factors, and it would be in vain.
Can I ask you a question that you're probably the person most in the world able to answer, and that is, why in Sound Exchange is the appellee, the Librarian of Congress, not the board? I mean, the board reached the decision, right?
Yes.
My question.
The board reached the decision.
I mean, and in this case here, we have the board as appellee, which I guess is sort of the sort of thing we'd expect. None of us is surprised by that. Mm-hmm. But I guess on reflection, I am surprised that the librarian is the appellee in Sound Exchange.
I'm not sure I follow when you say the appellee in Sound Exchange.
Well, I'm just looking at the caption in our case. This is a case at 571.
Oh.
Are they the intervener?
Your case.
Yeah, we're interveners here. We're defending.
I understand that. But I'm talking about the case where you were appellant.
Oh, in the prior case?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Judge. I see. I think it has sort of The true answer is I don't know, and I don't want to make up an answer for
fair
you.
Fair enough. That's absolutely it's always fair been the answer. Convention always to a do fair
so.
Answer.
It's always been the convention to do so. It may be required by statute, and I can look that up for
yeah.
you.
I mean, the other question is when the court gets to, and I mean, this is really unfair question because I'm asking about what may have been going on in the mind of the panel. When it gets to the Section 112 rate, it says the Register of Copyrights rendered such and such an opinion, and court treats that as ending the matter. As I mean, what the Register of Copyright said is treated as final. Mm-hmm. That seems to be in tension with subsection E of 802F1, so forth. Which says that the role of the register has no effect on judicial review.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, I don't know if you were referring to the prior case where the register actually sort of reversed in a sense, or
right.
For the fact that there was no ephemeral rate.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
And. There was no ephemeral rate, and the register said there needs to be an ephemeral rate. And the parties then actually settled. They actually agreed upon an ephemeral rate and submitted that to
the Copyright Board. I guess what's curious to me is we didn't regard the register's legal conclusion as reviewable, although, I mean, the fact that he had the right to impose his view of the law on the board wouldn't ipso facto establish that he had the right to impose that view on us.
I think that's right. I would have to, honestly, I would have to look back at the procedural issue.
Okay.
Since that.
So I'm just trying to unearth this archaeology.
No, that is perfectly legitimate. And I will unearth how exactly that came up and whether there was a way for that to have gotten to this court. I know no party did so, and that might just actually be the answer.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'll look that up. I do want to address.
I want to get to what the least worst result would be.
Yes, and that's what we want. The
you want to give us a hint as to what that might be, just in case?
Obviously, we think that that there's no constitutional infirmity here. But if remedy were required, I think just declaring the copyright royalty judges as an institution unconstitutional and letting the chips fall where they may really would be a crisis. There really are billions of dollars at stake for the decisions that the CRJs have made. I think number one, it would be important to make clear that prior decisions for which appeal has lapsed or perhaps appeal has already been completed would not be somehow collaterally attackable. Number two, what you would have if just going forward you had sort of no CRJs and no remedy, what you would have is a statutory license with no recourse if the parties can't arrive at a statutory royalty through negotiation. At that point, services, first of all, would have to go to individual record companies, individual copyright owners, for individual licenses. That's a very inefficient system, and it's exactly why the statutory license exists. It's to make this process possible with scores of copyright owners, millions of artists, and hundreds, if not thousands, of services. You really would have chaos if every company had to go
to negotiate. I understand that argument, and I think it's compelling, but I think it tends to undermine your suggestion that the principle of looking to private sector voluntary agreements sort of makes it all pretty simple for the judges.
No, actually,
because it's quite a difference between the take it, these clusters of copyright owners for which the board is making a decision and individual contracts between a particular copyright owner and a particular user.
I actually don't think so. I don't think there's any inconsistency at all. And I certainly don't want to be misunderstood that suggesting that the CRJ's job is simple. It's not. But they have done a more straightforward analysis than was suggested. What they've done essentially is say this is non-interactive webcasting, so it's not on demand. It works just sort of like AM/FM radio. You turn it on and you get what the programmer plays. And so they have looked to interactive webcasting, the more on-demand services, and they have looked to those agreements, which obviously share similarities. There are differences, and they have made those adjustments. So they haven't been, they have focused on what are the most analogous agreements. Okay. I do think if the court identifies a constitutional infirmity, which of course I don't think there is one, but if the court identifies a constitutional infirmity and if it is able to order that provision be excised or amended to be constitutional, as the court did in Free Enterprise, essentially severing that provision, then we have number one, a much more workable situation than
The problem is which provision. So there's a spectrum here. Mm-hmm. One is degree of supervision. One is degree of removability. One thing we might do is say they're removable without cause. That's certainly the easiest thing to do. The other is to say their decisions are reviewable by the register. Mm-hmm. Which of those two is the right solution here? If I've already got your view that wiping the whole thing out isn't the right solution. So yes. What is the right solution?
Sure. And I forgot to mention that there are cases pending before the CRJs right now, one of the biggest ones in terms of the amount of money at stake, that truly billions of dollars are at stake at that one. It is pending right now. It is being litigated. It's an interesting position for me to be in.
Oh, doesn't anybody ever think of the possibility they might lose?
if the question were, or if the decision were, that the CRJs as a board are unconstitutional because they are not removable at will. If the decision is there unconstitutional because their decision is not reviewable.
It's always the combination.
Right,
it's clear that it's the combination.
Yeah.
Right.
If it's a problem, it's the combination in this case. So assume that just doesn't mean this is how we're going to come out, but
sure.
we need to know what to do the next stage if we did come out that way.
Sure.
You do not have a view as to which thing
no,
we should
I do.
Sever, or is it?
Of those two, I think review by the. It's funny, having started, I think there are pros and cons to both avenues, having litigated these cases, I think it's four times now.
It would not change.
Either would be effective.
I see. Okay. Well, all right. Thank you. Have the argument. Any other questions? All right. We'll hear from Mr. Wright, who's now formulated an answer to this question.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope you'll give me indulgence to address two things, the sort of question of sort of what's the least bad thing the court could do, but also the issue Mr. DeSantis brought up about the relative unimportance of the factors.
Right. Those are the two things I'd like you to address. Right.
Great. Thank you. Well, with respect to the second one.
Well, can you start with the least bad, just since, okay. Since we were in the order of.
We think that this court ought to leave it to Congress to decide how it wants to do this. First of all, Congress can certainly order rates frozen for a year or two, and that's not the end of the world for anybody. There are rates in place for everyone, and one hopes that at least could be accomplished.
Does that include the ones that he said were pending?
Yeah, their rates there. Everybody's got rates in place. But there really are at least three options here. The president could appoint the judges. My own sense is that actually is the proper result. These judges really do important things. They ought not have such a small staff. They ought to be presidential appointees. The prior tribunal, the Copyright Royalty Tribunal, members of that tribunal were appointed by the president. I think that's the best legal answer. Of course, the librarian could be told to have to do review.
Appoint and remove without cause? You would change the remove without cause part or not?
I think that that's the appropriate. I think that strikes me as the best legal solution, to have the president appoint and be able to remove. That certainly addresses all the policies.
That's one that Congress would.
In the best.
That's one within the power of Congress, not us.
And I think Congress ought to choose here whether that, working with the administration, whether that's the right one, or whether the librarian ought to have, something closer to fuller review where it can actually overturn the rate decisions, or it could choose just to fire and see whether that's enough. But I think Congress ought to do that. Candidly, I think this is a statute that badly needs to be rewritten for reasons I'll tell you in responding to Mr. DeSantis's other point. But yes, this court wants to do the minimal damage, but I think what this court should do is declare the board to be unconstitutional and say that there are these various options that Congress could adopt. But I think I don't think it's obvious that Congress would prefer any one of them. Now, let me quickly add that choosing to allow the librarian to be able to fire the judges would raise questions, would address our second appointments clause issue. Is the librarian the head of an executive department who may appoint the judges, even if they are?
But leaving that aside, would eliminating the for cause eliminate the inferior officer problem?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the judges would still be appointed by the librarian.
No, I understand that, if the librarian, so you lost the argument with respect to the librarian, and the only question is whether they are sufficiently supervised under Edmund.
Right. I said it.
I'm not saying you did.
If I lose the question, yeah. If the court decides that the librarian is the head of an executive
yes.
department, then yes, that objection goes away.
But then do you agree that it is sufficient to? I appreciate that's not the answer you want, but does it eliminate the appointments clause problem to make them removable?
Again, I think the best reading of Edmund is that what is required is either presidential appointment or full review within the Library of Congress. But I have to admit that.
And you disagree, although you cited Judge Kavanaugh before, you disagree with his dissent in Free Enterprise, which said if an officer is removable at will and is not the head of a department, the officer ordinarily may be considered inferior for purposes of the Appointments Clause.
Right. Well, I'm sorry. The board in that case, that was a different case because that board was subject to sort of complete review by the SEC on the merits. And so it's not a fully answered question whether just the ability to fire would be enough. It certainly is 100% clear that if the president were to appoint these officers or if there was full review within the library, which I think would be beyond the scope of this court's power to order either of those, a matter. So the safest, this is a political decision that ought to be properly addressed by Congress. I appreciate the court's concern that Congress might not do its job, but I think this court's job is to identify the
I don't think our question is whether Congress might do its job. I mean, we have an example of the Supreme Court doing exactly what they had. They had similar problems identified, and they show us how to fix it. It's not a question of question. I mean, and in that case, they say that we're going to take the least bad alternative unless we think that Congress would not have wanted it, would not have passed the entire statute had it been that way. And I haven't heard anybody with any evidence one way or the other on that point.
Well, let me suggest that sort of our third argument that I haven't mentioned yet is the argument about sort of Congress telling this court it could actually set the rates. And let me just use it in this context for one limited point. I think that's evidence that Congress wanted somebody to be able to reverse the board's rates. And this court, we don't think this court should do it, and we don't think this court has the power to tell the librarian or the register that they can do it. So there is a real question in my mind about what Congress would do upon learning that the copyright royalty judges are unconstitutional under the Appointments Clause.
Okay. And what do you think of, if I sort of can phrase the argument in its most more extreme, that there aren't really a lot of factors here, that the key policy decision has already been made, that policy decision is you look to analogous free market decisions and then you make adjustments?
Well, that's wrong. And as Judge Williams said, the real question is whether the deals are parallel. And I represented a party that dropped out in this case, but we filed initial papers at the board. And our initial papers were all about those factors. In this case, there were two groups of market agreements at issue, one of which was the broadcasters, and Sound Exchange liked those sets of agreements because they had relatively high rates in our opinion, because the broadcasters don't like webcasting and it's not their job and they like having high rates. There was another set of rates that applied to so-called pure play webcasters who are small businesses or relatively small businesses who do nothing but webcasting. And so there was an argument, as a legal argument, the board ultimately decided that it couldn't even look at this one group of agreements. But we argued at great length then under the factors that the broadcasters' agreements were not analogous to those of a webcaster who's not also a broadcaster, for many reasons, including the fact that the relative contributions on nearly all of those factors are greater for a webcaster, because a broadcaster is already in the business of playing music and a lot of what they do is just rerun it on the web, whereas webcasters are very different. So in the real world, the issues about what these factors mean come up all the time, and the board couldn't say they're just irrelevant. They're very much at the heart of the rate-making decision in this statute.
Okay, hearing no further questions, we'll take the matter under submission. Thank you very much. I don't know.